Body, Mind, Spirit Radio, your live connection to the information for a healthy body, an enlightened mind, and a renewed spirit.
And good day, everyone. It is 11 a.m. on the 3rd of December 2012. That is 11 a.m. Eastern. You are tuned in to Insights with Elaine Kissel. This show is heard live the first Monday of every month at this time. This is an hour-long program, and it's all about you, your consciousness and subconscious mind, your whole mind, and it will give you meaningful insights and useful information, along with the tools that you can use to access your inner resources more effectively. Today's program does feature Dr. Elaine Kissel welcoming you to enjoy her conversation with Professor Keith Scott Mumby. He is going to enlighten you on a topic of health and wellness. They are longtime colleagues, great friends, and some knowledgeable people who are going to create a dynamic hour of conversation here to inform and educate you. We welcome the host of the show, Elaine Kissel.
Well, good morning, everyone, and good morning, Dr. Keith. It's wonderful to be able to connect with you this way because I've been following you for a long time, and we both have a lot in common about the mind-body relationship and consciousness. And so my feeling is today, more than anything else, because your knowledge and experience and studies are so vast, I'm going to ask you, what would you prefer to speak about right now?
Well, first of all, let me say hello, Elaine, and it is, as you say, a great pleasure to sit down and have a chat like this, especially about such awesome subjects, you know, as mind and consciousness. We throw these words around as if we got any understanding of what they are. They're huge concepts, aren't they? So it's great what you're doing, and I love that. I thought that since this is my first time talking with your audience, it would be great to introduce them to one of my ideas, things that I call thought structures, and I've got one called the 12 channels of being. And I think this will be good. It's a very important way of looking at life. It's, as you know, you've read it yourself, it's completely innovative, a new way of looking at things. But can I just take a minute to explain what I mean by a thought structure? I used that word just now. This is an idea I've kind of invented. I mean, I don't mean I've invented thought structures or minds or pieces of minds, but what I mean is I've come up with the idea of putting this label to it, and I can see a sort of functional entity in the mind. It just simply means a way of looking at things, like an overlay. You know, you can lay it over life like transparent plastic with boxes and lines on it and so on, and you can interpret your life in that way. I suppose the simplest idea like that would be a list, wouldn't it? I mean, you just make a list of things. It's a way of looking at life and a way of looking at tasks or opportunities or ideas that you've got. So even a simple list is a kind of thought structure. But the one that I want to talk over with you is a little bit more complicated than that. I call it the 12 channels of being. Elaine, as you say, you've followed my writings. You'll know it's had a few incarnations. Once upon a time, I called it the R zones, R standing for responsibility. And there's a bit of a joke behind that because, you know, there was a very famous book back in the 60s called Your Erogenous Zones, and of course you know what
that is. Oh, yes.
And I'm sure it's a bestseller because people, you know, it was a bit smutty. And then Wayne Dyer did really well with Your Erroneous Zones, and I'm absolutely convinced that millions of people bought his book thinking it was more smut, and that made Wayne famous. Lovely book, by the way. It is just a light-hearted remark. But anyway, I thought, well, R zones, let's go for that. Maybe people will get my book for the same reason. Anyway, I shifted gear a bit and called it consciousness zones, but now I prefer to think of it as channels, you know, the kind of energy flows, if you like, you know, ways of flowing thought and life and consciousness energy into life. So if you're ready, tell me, I'll go.
I love it because, you know, when I read the book, And I admitted to you when I talked to you a while back that I hadn't done the exercises yet, but I was fascinated because, as you say, once in a while you come across a theory or a model that totally changes the way you think, feel, and speak. Your book did that. It definitely did.
Oh, wonderful. Well, you know, for such a prestigious work as you, I'm very flattered and pleased by that because, you know the mind inside out. So if you feel it's added something, added an extra layer of understanding, then I'm very delighted. Okay, well, let's not stay in the abstract. You know, for the listeners, let me just lay out what we're going to be talking about, really. As I said, channels of being and ways of looking at aspects of our existence, starting from the tiny inner part right through to the whole totality of everything, you know, God, the universe, everything, whatever you want to think of. And these are my choices. Now, I better say that you could maybe do 100 channels, I don't know. Or you could divide life up into very simple things like, you know, animal, vegetable, and mineral. But I think that's too simple. You know, it doesn't help. Whereas this view, I think, does. And I choose to start with the inner self, the actual self, the being, the consciousness within, and that internal domain, which we think of as things like character, our nature, personality, our experiences and memories and so on. That's where I begin. That's the sort of core me, if you like, or core you, or core us. So that's my channel number one, the inner channel of self. But then you have to match that up, really, with the outer channel of self, because it's not just our inner mind and being. You know, we are a body, we have a gender, typically, you know, we have a job, and we surround ourselves with a home and effects and all of these I consider my second channel of being, the outer self. And that includes a lot of things. I mean, job for a start. We are really defined by our job, if you think about it, Elaine. People say things like, you know, I am a doctor or I am a lawyer. And that's kind of how people think too. You know, what you know and your skills in a way define what you are in life. But there's other things in that channel too, you know, one's preferences in music and art. I mean, even playlists could belong in that channel if you think about it. I want to share this with you. I read a very interesting piece a couple of weeks back about changing your playlist, changing your life, changing your emotions, changing the way you look at things. And of course, you know the power of music. So if you select harmonious, beautiful music for your playlist, you're going to be a very different person to if you, your playlist that you keep bombarding yourself with is largely heavy metal rock and loud, discreative and rather sharp music. So it's very important, even things like that, you know. Anyway, listen, I don't want to spend too long on each channel because we want to talk about the concepts, don't we? What would be number three? Well, to me, that's pretty clear. That's your romantic sexual relationship, your special loved person, the other. And this can be very broad, of course, in this modern, enlightened day and age. It doesn't have to be just man and wife anymore. But it's a very, very powerful flow of being and energy, probably one of our most powerful channels. It's so powerful that sometimes it overwhelms people, you know, and they actually come to the point of death through this love and romance thing, either giving up their life for the one they love or sometimes being so upset and sick from loss that the person wants to commit suicide even. You know, that big. Wow, that is kind of a big energy, isn't it? But then separate from that, at least the way I look at this, separately, I would put the family line or what I call the protoplasm line. They're not actually exactly the same thing, and I think that's one of the problems that people have. They try and exactly match and identify the romantic sexual idea with family, and that means children and progeny, and also we've got to include our ancestors in that. And I don't think there's an exact match, Elena. I hope you agree that it's right to just separate them. They belong side by side, but they're not exactly the same thing. And in the protoplasm line, there's one's ancestral history. We don't bother with that too much in the West, do we? But a lot of what I consider enlightened societies, not primitive societies, pay great honor and respect to the ancestors, especially grandparents, you know, show up in the North American Indian tradition or the Chinese. So that's important to us. And then, of course, we go down the protoplasm line through our children to our children's children and so on. We have that great responsibility too. So number three and four are probably pretty powerful. In fact, if you put one, two, three, and four together, that's us. You know, that's us as a person and a part of a family unit. Okay, mm-hmm. So number five, I have tribes. Tribes and tribing, we all belong to different kinds of tribes. And I don't just mean, you know, ethnic Indian tribes or groups. The golf club is a tribe.
Yes.
People who love Jane Austen novels is a tribe. Sorry, Lynn, what? Sorry, did I interrupt you?
No, okay, go on, I'm listening.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, there's an important phenomenon here in the tribing thing. I call it constellations. And what you see, and you know Bert Hellinger's work, I'm sure, but these are kind of not necessarily family constellations, but people who circle around each other, and this comes from work in, you know, past lives and other entities and so on, that people seem to keep meeting up and still keep trying to solve problems, and they keep showing up over and over, and I call these constellations, and that's a very big part of my fifth channel or tribes. Okay, so next up would be mankind as a whole. Of course, we are part of all of mankind, and we're intimately bound in its fate. If mankind perishes, we're not going to be around. And I've subdivided it a little bit. I've picked off the internet and that social networking, connectedness, electronic thing that we've got today as a kind of special case of mankind. And I think it's growing so much in power and stature, there's no telling where it will go. But I think it is quite capable of and is already beginning to shift human consciousness, you know, that we're aware of things differently because of our huge interconnectedness via the internet. Very exciting. What would be bigger than that? Well, the ecosphere, of course, all living things. So that's my channel 7. We're all part of the ecosphere, and if we're not smart and destroy the ecosphere, once again, we're gone too. But that's living things. Okay, beyond that is the physical world, everything that's physical, you know, the earth, planets, stars, moons, the oceans. It's a very physical world, and science today has us kind of believing or tries to sell us on this story. That's the real thing, you know, that reality is what is. You know, you can have all these ideas that you like, but this is the real stuff. This is reality against which we measure things. But it's funny and ironic that under the onslaught of quantum physics, the so-called real world is sort of rapidly evaporating. We realize that time isn't what we thought. It can go backwards. Some scientists think time is just an illusion anyway. There isn't really space anymore because this non-locality things shows us that we're all everywhere all at once. So what does space really mean? You know, when we grew up as kids, space was something that separated objects. You know, I'm over here, it's over there, that kind of separateness thing. Whereas now it seems that space really brings everything together. You know, we're all one, we're all connected. So the real world isn't necessarily that real. But anyway, it is physical. It's what we consider and recognize as the physical world. Anything outside that, you know, that doesn't that include everything? Well, no, because ideas and things of the mind, concepts, creativity, all belong in a different dimension, really. And to me, that's a channel of being as well. If you take music and take a composer like Mozart or Beethoven, those persons are still here in a very real sense via their music and their creations. So, it's, you know, it's more than just an abstraction. It is a living life survival channel. And in that, I include history also. You know, history with some races and some tribes has an almost sacred meaning. You know, it's very much part of how they, well, it is how they came to be, isn't it? And they give it enormous respect. And I would put history in my channel 9 too. So this is, we've moved on to very conceptual, abstract ideas kind of things that are classic for human beings, but not necessarily relevant to the physical world. My channel 10 would be, this is where I go a bit woo-woo, Elaine, but remember, you know, when I came over here, I lived in California for years. But this is spirits, discarnate entities, and all those weird things like other realities. And, you know, this is not woo-woo anymore, really. Modern physics is calculating with maths and statistics and all sorts of other tools and devices that there must be other dimensions, other universes than the ones that we're familiar with. Maybe they overlap and interconnect. Maybe they don't. But there's not really any argument anymore that there's lots of universes out there. And I'm not even thinking of that, you know, that infinitely dividing universe of Rupert Everett's idea. it's just like a, you know, statistical scientific thing that there are many separate universes. So we're nearly at the end. I've got 12, and we're off into very strange woo-woo other reality things at number 10. What can be left? Well, number 11 is what's sometimes called the universal web or the cosmic web. It's that great life, living consciousness, energetic, that unites all things, shamans and spiritual healers and people like you, you know, that have used the mind to enter other dimensions and other spaces and realities, know that there's something out there that's like a, it's almost like the old scientific ether, you know, they've decided the ether doesn't exist, but there is this thing, and it's been called the, you know, the zero point field and the web and all those kind of things too. There's something out there at that level that unites us all. And then finally at 12, I would, top of the pile, I would put God, you know, the creator, whatever, you know, if you're not have a God-based belief, like Buddhists, for example, but everyone believes in some great overarching power, creative thing that brought it all to be, and that would be my channel number 12. And funnily enough, 12 leads almost directly back to 1, doesn't it? Because channel 12 is what gives rise to your channel 1, your inner sense of self. So I offer these very humbly as a sort of interesting way of looking at things, and a way of sort of splitting up your life into partitions so you can see what's happening. And there are certain benefits for that, as you know, having looked at the book, Elaine. Anyway, any comment or any help so far?
Well, yes, actually, because as I'm listening and as I was reading, and I was thinking that there isn't actually a demarcation line in any of the, from channel to channel. So could you perhaps maybe comment a bit on how these different channels interact and influence each other?
Yes, well, of course, that connectivity is one of the great things that, I mean, we know it's there, but when, as I wrote about this, I realized I was writing a different and almost structured perspective on what interconnectedness really meant. Maybe I should just go back to the thought structure idea for a minute and just say this is really a bit like when I started, it was a bit like having a huge, nasty, untidy bunch of clothes and effects on the floor. You know, it's just a bundle, a mess. But if you begin to sort it out into separate drawers, you know, like you've got socks in one drawer and you've got underwear in another one and then outdoor wear and then your best gear and so on, then once you start dividing up all this tangle of clothes, then it starts to make sense and becomes useful. And it's a bit like that with this, the channels of being idea. But how would we lay them out? You know, I've listed them, but is that necessarily the best thing? For example, would number one, channel one, would that be the most important? Or would God be the most important? You know, in a pile, which would be on the top, I mean. Would you put God on top because it leads to everything? But that then makes the individual very inferior, doesn't it? You know, like we're sort of bottom of the heap. And that, although that tends to be a bit of a Christian teaching, it's not something that empowers me. I don't think of myself as an individual like that. Another idea I had was to lay it out as circles. You know, like the inner circle was self. Outside that were other circles like the family. We were part of family, and then mankind. We were part of mankind. Our ecosphere, it was all part of the ecosphere. That concentric circle idea worked quite well too. But what I finally came up with was the idea of a clock face divided into 12. You know, 1, 2 through 12. What I liked about that was once you've got round, you know, you've moved up from 1 to 2 to 3, once you get round to 12, you automatically go back to 1. And that's just what I was saying, really, that, you know, that your 12th channel gives rise to your first channel, is the meaning, you know, is the impetus, is the excitement, as it were, for the first channel. So I think that works very well. But here's the thing, Elaine, if you think about a clock face divided up, there is a point in the center of the dial where everything meets, isn't there? You know, all the lines intersect in the center and they all touch, like slices of a cake. Every slice touches every other slice at the middle of the cake. So, you know, it's clear that all these things are connected. You can't, there is no meaning in an idea that, you know, something here is separate from something else. You know, your family line is part of the ecosphere, obviously. And, you know, your ancestors are connected with your own self. You know, they're a part of you. You carry some memory in them and so on. You could draw endless crisscross lines of saying, well, that's linked to that and that's linked to that. Yes, that's linked to that. You could go on for hours. So I think it's neat to be able to put it into compartments and say, these are the chief things to focus on. And I hope people, having listened a while, would realize now that this is about right. You know, as I said, just doing three simple ones like animal, vegetable, and mineral doesn't really help you with laying out your life realistically, does it? Or giving it the right kind of emphasis. On the other hand, to divide it into hundreds of different things, you know, like current friends and past friends and boyfriends at school and boyfriends after school, doesn't help either, does it? It just becomes confusing. I think this is about right, you know. 12 is a very magic number, as you know, in the Western world, especially the English-based world. We had the dozen and we had the 12 inches to the foot. We used to have 12 pence to the shilling. For some reason, 12 was a very big number for the British. it's called a duodecimal system. It means 2 and 10. Well, of course, Britain's mostly moved on to the decimal system about 30 years ago. But there are vestiges of it there. And, of course, we meet it elsewhere. You know, the 12 signs of the zodiac, for example. We've got the 12 disciples. So people are somehow fascinated by this number, 12. Maybe it's one of those kind of just right numbers. You know, 10's a bit small and 15's too big, but 12 is just right, a Goldilocks number.
In your book, you talk about, you ask a few questions. For example, could you use a new definition of happiness that goes beyond the warm, fuzzy feeling we all know and love? That's a fascinating concept.
As I said, it leads to other ideas, doesn't it? Like, what does happiness mean, and what is good and what is right and wrong? We can talk about those. But happiness really means simply, on this model, it's only a model, but on this model, happiness means having it just about right in each of your channels. If you get too overstretched on one channel, then you start to hurt other channels. Now, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm not suggesting you need to put 1/12 of your time into looking after mankind and 1/12 of the time looking after your children and so on. That's not what I mean. But all of those things have to integrate and have to work, and there has to be some understanding of them there somewhere in what you do with your life. So, for example, if you're all totally on 1 and 2, or let's say 2, you're a very selfish, acquisitive person, greedy, just, you know, thinking of nothing except acquiring, you know, wealth and possessions, then you're a bit out of balance, and you're very likely going to hurt your third and fourth channels, you know, your spouse or your lover, and your kids and family are probably going to get hurt. If you see yourself as being a worker for mankind, you know, maybe a missionary or that kind of thing, or a volunteer worker that wants to give their whole life to serving others and looking after the sick and needy, beware, because that's, you know, you can get unbalanced. It's a very worthy aim in itself. But if the worthiness leads you to become really quite excessive in zeal so that all the other ones fall out, then it doesn't work. I mean, it just logically doesn't work, Elaine, because what happens is your first and second bits fall apart. So people like that might, for example, find themselves getting, you know, very impoverished and very sick, very stressed, because, you know, if you can't pay the rent, can't put food on the table, that's very stressful, as you know. Well, I mean, what use are you to saving mankind if you're in that kind of state? So you've got to take care of other channels to be able to function on a channel which you're very passionate about. So, you know, you need to balance them up. And I think happiness is coming as close as you can to getting a balance or a full functionality in all of these, shall we say. As I said, you don't need to.
Balance is very, very hard in today's world, as you know, Keith, because of all of the demands on our attention, our consciousness, and the pull on consciousness from all sources outside. So how, in your mind and your theory, do we balance this?
Well, I mean, first of all comes knowledge and awareness. That's the step one to solving any problem or changing any conditions of life, is to be aware of what's happening, and, you know, to have knowledge of how to make changes, isn't it? So it's helpful in that sense, just to know about these things and to have them in front of your mind. That's a very good beginning. Also, if you can see imbalances, then it is possible to bring in, well, what do they call it? Checks and balances in the United States law, isn't it? Mm-hmm. They have this concept that they call checks and balances.
Mm-hmm.
So if something gets a bit excessive in one direction, then there's something else will pop up, like a governor in a machine pops up and switches the engine off until it slows down a little bit. I think that sort of idea. So, I mean, being aware of it is probably the number one resource that a person could have. And, for example, you know, there might be listeners out there thinking, well, what does the ecosphere have to do with me? You know, what can I do? Well, you know, the answer is we can all do something. If you run a busy career and you don't have much time, you know, make a donation or contribute in some way. You will feel psychologically better and more balanced if you're engaged in each of these levels. Maybe a person isn't very much on ideas and, you know, concepts and history and things. They say, well, I don't like music and I hate Beethoven. Yes, but, you know, there is a lot of knowledge in books that are very relevant to humans, and I think we all should try and fill our lives with more reading and learning. Any person who's got a broad education is going to do better than someone with a very limited education or a very narrow education. I don't know about you, Elaine, but I learned most of what I know after school, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
That's where it's like getting out of school wasn't the end of learning. It was the beginning of learning. It was like a license now to go out and learn. At least I could read and write, so I could pick up books and study things I wanted to learn about, and did. And there are a sad lot of people, especially in this country, that don't take much trouble to improve themselves like that. Well, you know, that's not going to lead to happiness, is it? You know, there are lots of good modern living theories out there, but if you don't read about them and see what's going on, then you stay in just the same old limited state all your life. So Channel 9 is demanding, really, that you learn and improve yourself, and it's a lifelong learning for those of us that take this seriously, isn't it? I mean, there's no end to learning. Getting a degree.
Well, you know, Keith, I can hear in my psychically hear people who are less formally educated arguing that life is so demanding that just doing what it takes to survive from day to day, and maybe not even being able to afford the time or the money for further education, that would be what we're asking. This is a great challenge. How does someone in that
well,
situation...
Well, that's true. I mean, you're touching, aren't you? Really touching here. Well, not touching. You're stamped on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which you know well. And the most fundamental needs are, you know, life, air and water and food, the things that you absolutely have to have for survival. All the rest is very fancy and theoretical if you haven't got the basics for survival. So, yes, it's sad that there are people in that condition. I don't think there's anyone in this country that's sort of totally without the resources of a few hours a week, even if they're having to work very hard. The question is, how do you spend those resources? Most people slump in front of the TV and they're counter-educated, as I prefer to call it. The stuff thrown at them on television. So even a person being aware of this and with so little time could still make a selective choice and say, well, I'll watch a PBS channel and learn something about the world around me instead of watching this stupid so-called thriller, which is just 90 minutes of people shooting each other up and doing nasty, vile things. People always have choices, so you've got to come back to choices. But, you know, we're talking of how things ideally should be, and we're talking, I hope, to people who are interested in that, Elaine. So what can I do for people who, you know, don't want to better themselves or don't want to change their lives? The answer is not a lot. I've got a saying that you can't want it more for a person than they want it for themselves. So, you know, if you are concerned to change the conditions of people like that, I think you've got to change capable people first and sort of change the society dynamic so there are fewer people at the bottom end who can't survive. We've got glaring contrast in this country, haven't we, between you know, those who are doing well and those who have almost no resources and almost no recognizable life or pleasures to speak of. The gap is enormous. But, you know, other countries have solved the problem quite well, and I'm not thinking of communist countries, but, for example, New Zealand. It's a pretty, what we call it, a socialist country here, but, you know, there's nobody on the poverty line there. There is a big effort to redistribute wealth and to not have a few individuals hanging on to most of the nation's resources, and it's working. So, you know, taken collectively, and you would have to say this is at the tribal level, I think, Channel 5, you know, we're talking about governments and countries and political parties. Nobody, well, not many people like politics. It's such a grubby story. But, you know, I'm fond of quoting Plato saying, if you don't get interested in politics, then the penalty you pay is that you'll be governed by idiots. So I think there is some requirement that we get involved in some way and try and address these social issues. And I can only sum up my feelings, Elaine, by saying if everybody got a hold of and got to grips with all these 12 and did it, then there wouldn't be the kind of suffering people that you're talking about, because we'd all be drawn into aspects of tribing and mankind that would mean something important to us. And, you know, I think I think you've just steered me, actually, quite cleverly into the other aspect of this, which I wrote about, which is it has to do with, you know, what is right and wrong and what is proper behavior.
If you don't mind, I think we'd like to talk more about that in a minute after a message about you talking about how would you like to see all religious hypocrisy, Kant and dogma washed away, and a rational model and a new political system. So would I come back to that after this message, okay, Kate?
Oh, yeah, sure, okay.
Right, thank you. You are listening to Dr. Elaine Kissel's program, Insights with Elaine Kissel, that is heard live here on the first Monday of every month at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Please check your times in your time zones to equate that so you can make sure you don't miss a single moment of it. You can also go to bodymindspiritradio.com and catch all of Elaine's archives, and we do recommend that highly. And if you haven't read Elaine's book, The Mind is Willing, you've no idea what you're missing. It's been endorsed by lay and mind-brain scientists for being a powerful tool for getting in control of your mind, body, emotions, and behaviors. It's based on her Mind Mastery course and is packed full of easy-to-apply techniques to get your conscious and subconscious working as a team. Just the foreword and introduction alone make the book worthwhile reading. Every chapter will give you tools for developing a good working relationship with your subconscious while it tunes you into your personal power and teaches you how to employ it for achieving any desired outcome. There are many, many things in the book that are not in the course and vice versa. The book has been described as the handbook for life. Some people have referred to it as their source of daily inspiration and support, while others will call it their life skills Bible. As a companion to the Mind Mastery course, it will help you lock in your conscious control for your subconscious mind. And for just $19.95 plus shipping, you'll have it in your hands as a most valuable resource for how to access and employ your positive resources. You can order this online at elainekissel.com/book or call 248-865-9598 to order. The book, again, is The Mind is Willing by Dr. Elaine Kissel. And with her guest, Dr. Scott, I call him Dr. Scott Mombi, Dr. Keith Scott Mombi, we rejoin Dr. Elaine Kissel and Dr. Keith for the fascinating discussion, and I hope you've been taking notes because this is certainly a call to action on Insights with Elaine Kissel.
Thank you, Annette. Keith, tell us about this rational model for a whole new political system that's never been tried before.
Well, listen, most of us do think of politics as pretty irrational. It's very polar, and it's self-serving among politicians. It's group and tribe serving among the political parties and so on. Everyone wants their own side of the story, and it's sort of to hell with the other side, really. I don't know about you, but I'd love to see a political system where everyone is concerned for the whole and everyone is intelligently aware that they're part of the whole. You know, that you can't. One of the things I've learned over the years, and you've learned too, and it's sort of embodied in this table of channels, is... you know, that you can't just serve yourself to the exclusion of anything else. That old-fashioned idea, well, I'll grab what I want, to hell with the rest, just doesn't work because you are part of the rest. So, you know, I mean, at its most extreme, it's been said, but it's true, you know, that what's the point of being super rich if there's nobody around to drive you around in the car? You know, you can't get so lopsided that the society doesn't work as a whole. At the very least, you know, you want somebody to come and clean the house and someone to, you know, be at the store so that you can buy groceries and things. So extremism doesn't work, and I'd love to see a political party that's whole motivation and its manifesto was based on ideas like this, that we're taking the bigger, I mean, I've called this the bigger issue, I've used various phrases, but it really is life in the bigger issue. And only in very narrow parts of the world, with a very narrow view, through a very narrow space of time, have people ever believed that you can really just do it for yourself and to hell with the rest. It doesn't work, and most people know that. We've been through quite a window of that, you know, many decades of that in the United States. And I think it's starting to come unglued, and people are starting to realize that rather lopsided model, you know, it made a few people rich in the short term, but in the long term, it's not sustainable. I got into an argument with one somebody who said, are you some kind of commie? Because I'd say, well, it didn't seem right to me that a private individual should own a common planetary resource like oil. To me, that wasn't right. I mean, I'm not a communist. I'm not even a socialist, I don't think. But I'm logical, and I don't see how something that, you know, belongs to our planet that we all live on could suddenly be owned by somebody. They claim that they own it, they have it, and they're going to sell it to us at a disgusting, obscene profit that almost brings everything else to a standstill. I don't think that's communism. I was going to say if it's communism, I'm a communist. But I don't think that's communism. It's common sense. But this balance, if people could just understand this, all of these 12 channels in relation to politics, I think that could change our world dramatically and totally and forever. So, I mean, I wish it would.
But yeah, me too.
Sorry?
I said, me too. I wish too, but I think I am not sure how many people in the political systems would be open to what you're suggesting.
Well, you can keep bringing it back to this, Elaine, you know, that it's bad out there and people don't do it. But I'm an optimist. I've got to think, well, this would be the way to go. Let's get it started. There are times on Earth when somebody's had an idea and said, well, I think this is good. I'm going to tell people. And then it suddenly gained momentum. Mm-hmm. And that can be as varied as things like quantum physics. Or a religion, you know, Buddha sat down and said, well, I think it's pretty crazy getting all these passions and wild emotions and wanting this and demanding that. It upsets your system, it stresses you. Why don't we just chill and not worry about it so much? Well, he told other people that kind of idea, and it spread, and there are hundreds of millions of Buddhists in the world. You could say the same of, you know, Christianity and Islam and other religions, that once ideas get going, then they can change the world. And there's a famous saying of Margaret Mead, I don't know if you know, she was a brilliant American anthropologist, a wonderful writer, who said that you should never doubt that a small group of people could change the world. It's the only thing that ever has changed the world. And if you think about it, it's true, isn't it? I mean, Christianity came from like 12 guys. Well, 13, but, you know, like Jesus taught 12 people and they went out and shared it. And it kind of worked for enough people that it spread. So I'd like to think that that's not a barrier. You know, I'm not troubled or negged out, as the hippies say, by the fact that people are behaving stupidly. I have the optimism and belief that they can behave better. We need certainly some one-on-one changing of hearts and minds, and that's where the work that you do is so powerful. And I think we also need some concepts and plans and schemas, and that's where I think I'm powerful. And, you know, this is one of them. So I'm not troubled by the fact that people, you know, don't behave well. I think they're not seeing the bigger picture, and if they did, they would probably change. Well, they'd have to change, wouldn't they? Elaine, I should ask you a question now. If somebody understood these 12, in what sense would a person want to go and violate decent behavior and community spirit?
Well, I think that if we look at my sense is that, because I tend to be a humanist anyway, I believe that human beings have an inherent tendency towards good, although there are probably a lot of people that would argue that. And you're talking about radical new insights into the age-old question of right and wrong and good and bad, and I think that fits into this what people think in the political systems today, what's right and wrong and good and bad is not necessarily agreed upon.
Yes. Well, of course not, because they don't have a proper model, do they? I mean, like the Republicans think the only right thing is what the Republican point of view is, and Democrats think the only right thing is what the Democrats say is right, and the others are wrong by definition. They're both so extreme and polarized, it's damaging this society immensely. There's now such extreme polarization in politics. I think a very small percentage of the population actually move now. You know, the Democrats are being Democrats and will stay that way, and the Republicans stay that way. Nobody wants to compromise or meet in the middle ground. It's like compromise is a dirty word in politics. And yet compromise is the only way to get things done, really. Everyone can't have their own way all the time. In the short term, okay, it seems to work, you know. But in the long, in the short term, rich, greedy people can go out and get rich and greedy, and that's fine. But in the long term, it doesn't pan out. But the other way around, too, if, you know, people just want endless handouts and don't want to contribute, that doesn't last very long either, because they're not contributing anything. They're just putting their hand out for a disbursement. So all of these extreme things don't work in the long term, whereas I hope the balanced view does. And it's very difficult to, yeah. I mean, there are many judgments, aren't there, in the canon about what's right and wrong, and they're often religious based. You know, what is right is what God said, or what somebody said God said is right, and everything else therefore is wrong, and so on. To me, a better definition of rightness is something that has the most positive, creative power and energy on the widest possible range of these channels. And that's been described in various ways in the past as an old idealistic political philosophy called utilitarianism. It was popularized by a British philosopher called John Stuart Mill. And basically it meant, you know, the greatest good for the greatest number. The most people did well out of it, or, you know, the greatest happiness principle, he called it at one point. That even goes back to an earlier writer called Jeremy Bentham. And he had a kind of utilitarian ethics. You know, what worked best for the widest number of people was the best definition of right and wrong. And it had nothing to do with religious dogma or political teachings or anything else. It just, you know, how many lives were touched in a positive way versus how many lives were touched in a negative way. And, Elaine, you know, there are very few people using that kind of judgment on planet Earth right now. To inform their decisions. In fact, I think politicians would often rather die than change their point of view. You know, we said this is true, and therefore to admit that we might have been wrong is the worst, most horrible thing we will do. I mean, imagine all the votes we'll lose if we just even slightly suggest that we might have been wrong. They use this crazy thinking, which is crazy. You know, the only insane, intelligent behaviors I know are to try something, to evaluate how it did, and then change it if it didn't work so well. Can you think of anything better than that? I can't.
No, I can't.
Won't do it.
I think on the personal level, when you're talking about right and wrong, which is going to work for the most people or the most for the universe or whatever, on a personal level, can you put it on a very deeply personal level, Keith?
Well, I think so, and I think you have to, you know, because we are part of the bigger schema. So, really, just personal is almost, a false, a trick question, as it were, because you can't just be on a personal level. But I know what you're saying. You know, each of us is responsible for our channels, those 12 channels of ours, and obviously we overlap at things like tribes and especially at Mankind. But, you know, we each have our own pathway and our own choices. And I'm not saying that everyone has to lead the same kind of life. You know, some people are very excited by science and creativity. Other people are artists and so on. We all do what we do, but with a good framework, you can make sure that your choices tend to be in the right direction and tend to be intelligent and tend to be nurturing and supportive to others. And you'd think very carefully about something that you could see might harm other people. That's not to say it's bad necessarily. Okay, I raised in that book, as you know, the question of killing. Is it ever right to do something like that? Well, you know, I was born after the Second World War, but I mean, I'm very familiar with its history, and it was talked about in my household a lot when we were kids. Probably yours too. There's no question that Nazism was a very bad thing indeed and had to be stopped. So I'm very grateful for the brave people that fought and gave their lives, but it meant killing other people to get it stopped. But then the Nazis set up the rules that way. You know, we're going to kill you, and if you don't kill us, then too bad, you're all dead. So we were rather forced into that situation. But, you know, it's one of those situations where I think do nothing wasn't an option. These people planned to dominate the world and torture and execute hundreds of millions of people that didn't fit their model of an ideal person. And, you know, we know that's wrong. So you have to think carefully about it, but it doesn't mean a destructive action is never wrong. Is always wrong. There are times when to not do something is even more destructive than doing something that produces damage. So it's a vexed question, isn't it? But it does help with that story. I mean, in the terms of the greatest good for the greatest number, is it right to lock up terrorists or is it right to execute people? I don't think it's right to put people to death, by the way, judicially. And I'll tell you why. I don't care how bad they've been. You can't do it because sometimes you get it wrong. And no legal system and no political system can ever, ever, ever support the idea of ever once, by mistake, putting to death an innocent person. It's just unthinkable for a society to do such a thing. And so because the mistake rate is really quite high in prosecutions, then I think capital punishment is a no-no. But then you have to solve the problem, you know, the fact that there are people out there with murderous tendencies and, you know, psychotic solutions to things. But then, you know, wouldn't it all evaporate, Elaine, if you could bring this model to bear on people, if they were taught it in schools, all schools, you know, Muslim schools, Christian schools, any schools that were all taught this model, then it would be difficult for people to become extremist terrorists because they'd realize that it's only a tiny part of the, you know, that their tribe is not the only part of the story. At the moment, worldwide, the indoctrination of kids is into the fact that our tribe is right, the other tribes are rubbish, and we should kill them. And the Christians are just as bad at that, right? It's insupportable to think in these ways because we're all the same species. We can all interbreed and interrelate. So that's nature, if you don't want to say God's doing it, and say nature doing it, telling us that we're the same species, you know, and killing each other is just really quite absurd. So there are some very strong social and political imperatives buried in this if you take it to the full.
Well, I agree. I think we've got to get our consciences as well as our consciousness improved, definitely.
Yes.
I would like to just come back to one minute to the consciousness issue because, for example, your Eternity Project is the deepest probe so far into the origins and nature of being. And then when you talk about being and we talk about self, self is separate to the personalities that we portray in the stage of life. Consciousness of being, is that in your thinking something on a higher level?
Well, of course, there are a number of models for this, aren't there, Elaine? And it's difficult for any person to say, well, I think I've got it right. But, you know, having done a lot of work and seen that, you know, entities survive through time and through, you know, dimensions and let's call it past lives for want of a better word. I'm not particularly forcing that idea on people, but the consciousness survives. You know, it doesn't die or it doesn't go away. then the model that you finally come down to is there is the self, the you, as you know, as you were saying, and that's what we encounter on the streets. We have friends, the person we shake hands with or give a hug in the morning. That's a self or a persona, but that's a very complex entity based on a group of memories and a group of patternings. That's the self, and this all gets very Freudian, of course, the id and the ego and all these things. I don't think all those words matter, but the point is there is this narrow sphere of being that we recognize as a self viewpoint. But then there are higher dimensions to that, and as soon as you through hypnotism, as soon as you take a person out of that zone and let them expand into something wider, they start connecting with all sorts of much deeper and broader aspects of consciousness than they were ever aware of in their normal waking self. And I think we are connected, in the ways that we say. So in other words, the opinions and the emotions and the feelings of someone nearby to us, or are they somebody connected? They don't have to be geographically nearby, but are also part of our psyche. It goes beyond just saying, I could feel the atmosphere in the room. I think it goes beyond that, and that we are participating in these complex, multiple emotions from other beings and other peoples around us. But over and above that, there's a superarching, superordinate self that doesn't have the detail and the complexity and the confusion of self. It's a bigger thing, the higher self. But I think at the highest level, from what I've experienced and talked to people about, and also you can read it in scriptural books, there is a state where we kind of lose our selfness. We just blend with the higher thing in a very superb way, you can call it God or Brahman, the Hindus call it, and so on. But that we unite with this higher thing and lose our self-identity. And I think that's one of the problems people have with it, Elaine. I think they're a bit scared of losing the self-identity. It's like dying to lose the self. I suppose it is exactly what we mean by dying. when the self goes away, or we're fearing that the self will go away. But then the promise is that we're born into a higher something where, the really important part of us will survive. But then at the highest level of all, that maybe our self doesn't survive. We just become united back with the great overall everything. And I'm thinking of a really interesting, I don't know if you've come across the story of Anita Murjani, and she wrote this lovely book called Dying to Be Me. But she was a lady who was dramatically cured of cancer. There isn't time to go into the whole story, but she was at death's door and the family were called to see her off. And 4 days later, all the cancer had gone, and 10 days later, they couldn't find anything to biopsy even. She made this dramatic recovery, so she's here to tell her story. But the part that she tells that's very interesting is how she went back to source, the light and all those things. But she realized that the choice was to unite with that wonderful, loving, all-forgiving, unconditional love space, or to choose to come back and be Anita Murjani again for some longer time. And she came back, of course. But she says, and I think these words are lovely, and they fit so well with what I've thought for years, but she caught it in words in a way that I didn't. And it's so simple, I'm just crossed that she thought of it first. But she said, God is not a being, God is a state of being. Mm. And I think that says it. At the highest level, we are in that state of being where individuality and selfness really just doesn't matter anymore, where we're part of something so enormous. But then, a bit of a smarty aleck like me starts saying, well, what happens next? If it's all that good, why did we separate from it? And then the story begins, doesn't it? Because we all separated off from that wonderful divine at some point in the past and became individual consciousnesses, and then got ourselves all muddled up and confused, and so it goes on. So it'd be nice to go back, but then why won't we do it all again? That's my teaser question for you. What do you think?
Well, I wonder if the reason that we, as you say, we separated, what was the purpose of that? So that this is, we could go on and on, couldn't we, forever about all these things? And what I would like to do is to have you on again sometime so that we can talk more about some of the paranormal and parapsychological things that we both had a great deal of interest in over the years, and the research and experimentation in that area. So,
I'd love to do that, Elaine.
Yeah.
Absolutely love to. Can I just give a little plug for the book? Because there is a freebie copy. It's not that I want to sell this book. The people can go to a website and download it for free. And it's a site called abilitycafe.com. Abilitycafe, all one word, .com. And there's a little video there. You have to click on one of the tabs. There's a little video. You watch the video and you download the book free underneath. You don't need to give up your email address. It's not a trick. You can just have a copy of the book and share it with as many people as you want.
Oh, I love that you remembered to do that, because I was going to, so it saved me to remind people to do that. But also, can you give people the address to get to your newsletter that you send out via email?
Oh, yes. Well, that starts from my medical hat. So if you go to alternative-doctor.com, you can sign up there and you get all my mailings. And I'm going to a new system, Elaine, where people can choose whether they want more mind, body, spirit, or more of the vitamins and exercise things, or even some inspirational videos. So you can actually choose what kind of mailings you particularly like to receive from me. But that's another free site. It's a huge free site with thousands of pages, lots of information.
Well, you know, there's your knowledge bases and experience is so broad, it would be difficult to not to spend a lot of time with you on the internet. But what I would like to say about the 12 channels being, to me, when you talk about happiness, that's a strange word, because people, as you say, think of it in different ways. But when you say a whole new definition of happiness that goes beyond the warm, fuzzy feeling we all know and love, that in and of itself, I think, isn't it? Because everyone is seeking happiness. And it's even in the American Constitution, you have a right to seek that. So
right.
I think going about it in the right way and understanding what it truly is would make an enormous amount of difference in how people find it within themselves, in their lives. And I'm very grateful to you for this opportunity to share about the 12 channels being and all of your interesting ideas. And as you say, I'm certainly going to invite you on again, and we can talk for ages on all of these subjects. So is there some last moment thoughts you'd like to leave the audience with?
Yeah, well, let me say two things. First of all, quote, you know, Aristotle, who said happiness is our highest duty. It's not just a good idea. But if you interpret in terms of the 12 channels, you can see why happiness might be a duty. You know, we've got to fulfill it. But, you know, there's something else I could have said, and so in one sentence I'll have to throw it out. I could have called these the 12 acts of being as well, Elaine, because, you know, you have to do stuff. You know, you have to be yourself. You have to be a tribe member, and you have to be a mankind member, and so on. So I could have called them the 12 acts of being, couldn't I? It's been a great pleasure talking anyway, and I really appreciate the time to sound off like this. I hope I didn't get too soapboxy. I'm very fascinated by this idea and how it works.
Well, thank you very much for being with us, and I'll just say to my audience, just watch out for my new website is up, but it isn't perfected yet, so it's www.elainekissel.com, and I will look forward to meeting with you again next month, and I wish you a wonderful holiday season. Be safe, take care of yourselves, be well. Bye-bye for now.